Welcome to Motivated to Lead Podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. This is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Glad you could join us for our podcast this week. We're starting a two-part series with David Dennis. David is a nonprofit CEO, CEO of Eckerd Connects, which helps at-risk kids and families, doing some incredible work. He has some great insights, an incredible personal story that relates to his mission and his work. And he's going to share some great leadership lessons that he's learned over the years. And looking forward to this first part of a two-part conversation with David. It's great to have David Dennis join us. And David, you're in sunny Florida. And it's great to have you with us on our podcast today.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, Mark. Great to be with you.
Great. Well, I guess first off, can you just give us a little bit of your story? And we were talking a little bit. I'd heard your story in little bits and pieces, your personal story, and it relates to kind of your mission and what you're doing in your career. And we'd love to hear just a little bit of your story.
Yeah, I'd be happy to share that with you, Mark. You know, I've spent my entire career working with at-risk children and families. And it really goes all the way back to college. And when I was in college, I started volunteering as a big brother at a youth shelter. And it was in the old days, there was a commingling of kids that would never happen today. But in that old house outside the town of the college where I went, there was a house that was called Hope House. And there was children that had been removed by Child Protective Services that were waiting on placements for foster care or adoption. There were kids that had gotten into trouble with the law who were waiting on court dispositions. There were runaway kids. So I saw an ad on our bulletin board at the college and the opportunity to volunteer to be a big brother. So I did that. And that really was driven out of a real heart that I had for children and families that were going through those kinds of adversities, because I too had experienced a lot of that adversity myself. I lost my father when I was very young. He died when I was very young. Our mother succumbed to alcoholism and was not able to care for my sister and myself. We were also removed by Child Protective Services and separated and placed in different homes. We later got reunited by an aunt and uncle, got given a second chance. And so I think out of that experience, I just had such an overwhelming sense of gratitude for what I'd been given, that whenever I got to college and saw that opportunity to get back, I was a moth drawn to the flame. So that was never a thought in my mind that was going to be a career. I still remember the day I came home from there after volunteering out there for about a year. The director of the program called me in and set me down, and she said, "Hey, we've got a federal grant, and we're so excited about it. And we're gonna start paying you." And I said, "For what?" And she said, "Well, kind of what you're doing now, really, but you're gonna be able to get paid for it." And so, really, of all the services that I was providing them, all the volunteering, the activities I was taking the kids on, the opportunities for them going out and getting tickets and things for them to go to ball games or events and activities, tutoring, all these various things I was trying to help them with and just being there for them. They created a position called a recreation program coordinator. So I came home and I remember telling my roommate, who was also volunteering out there, who also started getting paid part-time, we thought we'd won the lottery. I mean, we could not believe we were going to get to do what we love to do, and they're going to pay us. We almost felt guilty. And so, matter of fact, I still remember talking to a guy that was out there as a full-time employee. And I said to him one day, his name was Joel Johnson. And I said, "Wow, Joel, you're out here more than we are." I mean, he said, "Well, it's because I work here. I just thought everybody was a volunteer out there." And so I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, this is my job." And when I found out that he went to college and got a degree in counseling, and it was a full-time job to counsel kids, I just couldn't believe that existed. So it was never a plan of mine. I just discovered it as I was following my passion. And so I, you know, that was really the beginning of it. I finished college. I went on to graduate school. I got my master's in marriage family counseling. And simultaneous to all that, though, I was also volunteering at our church as a youth minister, helping our youth minister. So after I graduated from college, I was asked to take a job as a full-time youth minister before I went to seminary. So I did that. And loved that. But I was in Nebraska, and our church was across the street from Father Flanagan's Boy Sound. And so all my spare time, I was over across the street volunteering with those at-risk kids that were placed over there on that campus who didn't have families. And I, even back then, I still realized looking back at it, I loved working with the kids at church, but they all had great families. They all had great lives. And my heart was really tugging toward these kids who just didn't have a family and had gone through what I'd gone through. So I went off to seminary, continued to be a youth minister there for a few years. And I started studying theology, actually, thinking, well, I'm going to be a youth minister. And I realized it about a year and a half into that theology degree that my heart was really, you know, with these at-risk kids. And I started, they started a marriage family counseling degree program at our seminary at the time. So I switched over to that degree and really didn't know what I was going to do. But all I knew was I wanted to help people. And so I got my degree, got out, and started working as a treatment team coordinator and doing group therapy with emotionally behaviorally disordered kids, and started doing private practice counseling on the side. Then I got married, and we started having kids, and I was doing counseling at night in my little private practice, and I was doing this treatment team coordinating and case management work during the day. And my wife said, you know, I really want to stay home with the kids. I don't want to go back to work. So I thought, well, I can't work night and day. You know, the kids are going to grow up and have activities. So I've got to figure this out. And my boss kept asking me to take a management role. And I'd told him no for 5 years. And he kept saying, oh, you're a natural leader. You've got all these great ideas. And I just laughed at the thought of not working directly with the kids and their families. And so really it was the circumstances of needing to make more money and needing to be home more. So I went back to my boss, and it was fairly mercenary motivation to go back and ask him, I said, what did the job pay that was in the management role, supervision role? And he told me, and it was what I was making doing both jobs I was currently doing. So I said, I'll try it. So it wasn't some, revelation from God that, oh, you're supposed to be in leadership. It was really a matter of I needed to provide better for my family, and something I think is very important. You know, listen to those around you that are telling you that you're good at something, because they may see it before you do. And so he was right. I did have a knack for leading. I was a problem solver. I am a creative thinker. I just never thought of applying that to systems beyond a family system. Mm-hmm. And so when I took on that role, I really continued to kind of follow similar instincts that I've used in working with dysfunctional family systems. It was a very difficult program I'd taken over. We turned it around. We got some awards for it. And kind of that from there till now, it's just been being called and asked to take on broader and larger responsibilities and opportunities as a leader. And, you know, once I realized, okay, this really is the path that God was leading me to, and I didn't realize it, I became a voracious student and reader of everything I could about leadership. I had a real passion around, performance and quality and perpetual performance improvement, putting systems in place to avoid organizations being personality centric, and really began to get a passion around what it meant. What excited me was working with a caseload of 12 kids. I could do what I knew needed to be done to make sure all 12 of those kids got great services and their best opportunity to thrive and mm-hmm. move in a different direction in their life. But when I began to run the whole campus, I realized, wow, by putting the right systems in place and hiring the right people and providing the right support, I can make sure all 36 kids are impacted. So that ability through people and systems and processes to make a more grand impact and a broader impact really excited me. And then that went from a campus to multiple campuses I was asked to run. And from there, running statewide systems, I ultimately, ran the Department of Juvenile Justice for the state of Oklahoma. And I had several national roles with nonprofits. That led me to Eckerd Connects, where I am now. And I've been here for almost 13 years as president and CEO. So that's kind of quickly how my journey began and how it progressed through. It was never a plan of mine, really, at all. I never, ever saw myself as a leader or a manager or a director. Frankly, I had zero vocational goals. I was an old hippie. And really all I wanted to do was work with kids and families. And frankly, until I got married and started having kids, I had really no monetary interest either. I mean, I if I had a couple of shirts and a pair of jeans in my gym bag, I'm good. And so, but you know, things change, you know, you fall in love and you start having kids and all of a sudden your priorities change and you have different passions.
Absolutely. Well, give us a little bit of, I'm familiar definitely with your organization, but I'm sure a lot of people aren't. And I know, you know, different parts of the country, you're serving a lot bigger audience than what you did when we first met, but give us a little bit of scope of how many people you serve and, yeah, and just a little bit about what you guys do as an organization.
Well, Equity Connects is about 51 years old. And we started out as an organization that really launched by providing outdoor therapeutic camping services to at-risk kids. Since that time, in 1968, we've evolved and kind of, I'll just take you to current day now. Back in the original days, we were probably 95% of our population was young people in the juvenile justice system in various states. Now we're probably 95%, and it was all residential services. Now we're probably 95% community-based services. Very little of what we do is residential. And we not only serve young people in the juvenile justice system, but we serve young people in the child welfare system. And we do a lot of what's called workforce development work, which is federally funded. And so the three primary populations we serve are people that are typically in poverty. There's a certain amount of economic instability in their home. And so we go in and help try, whether it's a displaced adult worker or whether it's a young adult or young person wanting to get their GED or finish their education, get job skills training, job placement, and help them get a pathway out of poverty through employment. And then we work with kids in the child welfare system that have ended up being removed from their children, and we provide foster care services. We provide in-home services to strengthen families so that families can be reunified. And we also work with young people coming out of lockup juvenile justice facilities.
So how many do you serve each year? What's the number now? That
about 35,000.
Wow. Yeah, that's grown. How much in the last 10 years has that grown?
Well, it's interesting, Mark. When I came, my first task was actually to close the original organization's programs. This organization was about $79 million annual revenue. It was all outdoor therapeutic camping programs, but they were losing about $3 million a year. And the best practice and research that was out there had shown that that was really not the most economic or most impactful way to serve those young people. Mm-hmm. And the states didn't want to keep paying that amount of money for that few kids to get services in these residential settings. And so, you know, all the evidence was showing that you could have a better impact in the lives of these young people with services that reached into their family, into their homes, and connect these kids with opportunities in their community versus removing them from their community into a residential setting. It was less expensive, so we could serve a lot more kids with the same amount of money and get better outcomes. So, like I said, the organization for about 10 years before I came, 10 years in a row, they were losing about $3 million a year, which was coming out of our endowment trust. And so it was, the organization was either had to reinvent itself and go a different path, or it was going to have to close. And that's when I was called and asked to come in to see if we could turn it around. And so we did. And so that original $79 million in annual revenue no longer exists. None of those programs exist. And those original 9,500 kids a year that were served, none of those kids are counted in this new 35,000 number. So everything that exists today has been built in the last 12 and a half years.
Wow, that's incredible. So I ask this question of every CEO we have on the podcast is, knowing what you know now, what would you tell a 22-year-old David if you were to give him some advice?
Several things, but number one, don't wait till you're 22 to start getting advice. Mm-hmm. I would say, you know, make sure that by the time you're 18, you've really began to explore several things. One, what's your life purpose? I think that's number one. That's the most important thing. And something that I would encourage every young person, whether they're in college or just out, to ask that why question. Why do you think you're here on earth? What is your ultimate purpose that you want to be committed to in your life beyond vocation? and you know what kind of values are going to accompany that purpose in your life. Within that purpose, what do you think your mission would be within that purpose? So for myself, and I encourage every young person to write their own mission statement, and mine is very simple, and I tell people try to keep it 10 words or less, but mine is to advance the potential of others. That's my heart. That's my passion. No matter what I'm doing, is I derive great joy and fulfillment in working with people and help them get a vision and discover what their potential in life is and put a plan together to move toward it. I love doing that myself. I love to help organizations do that. And so, but it's real important for people to do that, because if you're looking at working someplace or choosing a vocational path, you need to make sure that it aligns with your purpose. And you need to understand, if you were going to engage in that, how would you be able to fulfill your mission within that? The other thing I would say is, you know, look for opportunities to learn from people. For one, I would say, like I said, I would start when I'm 18, not 22. And when you get ready to get a college degree, don't get a college degree in something you're interested in. Get a college degree in something that will make you better. You know, I got a college degree in religion, which was worthless. And I did it because I was interested in it. It was what was interesting. Investing in a college education is something that's interesting, in my opinion, is a poor decision. You can study what you're interested in offline as much as you want. I studied as much about religion outside of the college classroom as I did in it, because it fascinated me. I was fascinated with what people believe and how that affected how they live. And so I would encourage people, study something that's going to make you better than you are without that degree. And so for me, I wish I had studied business, which is not a natural proclivity of mine. I wish I would have studied things like finance or economics, not because I'm interested in it, but because it's not a natural gift of mine. I would have studied project management, which is not a natural. So study to complement yourself, not to pleasure yourself. And I would say the same thing about when you're 22. When you get out of school, look for an opportunity to work someplace for somebody that you really admire and respect, who's doing well what you think you might want to do. Do some research. If you think you want to work in a specific area or a specific field, find out who does that the best. And find somebody that does that really well, who also aligns with your purpose and your values, so that you can get an opportunity. Go volunteer there if you can't get a job there. Get mentored. And go make a hand. I volunteered at my first job. They liked what I did, and I did it so well, they found a job for me. I've done that countless times for people that have come to volunteer at our organization. People hire character and teach skills if they're worth their salt. So I would tell young people when they're 22, I don't care what your job is, treat it like it's the only job you'll ever have your whole life, and treat it like it's a true personal expression of who you are, and it's an expression of what you say your highest purpose is. I mean, be a great employee, because when people get ready to promote people, what they're going to do is look at what you've done and how you've done it and who you were while you've done it. It's not so important really what you're doing and where you're doing it. It's who you are and whatever you're doing and how you're doing it. And so I would just really tell people to take young people to take themselves seriously, take every job seriously, and every job can lead to your next better opportunity if you execute it with that kind of attitude.
So is there any advice that you received that you would, looking back on it, you would have ignored?
Yeah, and
or I should have ignored?
Yeah, I did ignore it, and that was to follow the money. I had a lot of people, you know, try to direct me in that path. You know, you need to get a job, you need to get a degree and a job where you can make money. I think that's poor advice, personally.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.